Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Time to talk about your income taxes and our guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and teach tax seminars around the country. So as we talk with Mary, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about filing your taxes? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's nice to be here.
I'm happy to report that I have received in my bank account both my small refund checks from the federal and the state. So my taxes are all done, and the little money I had coming back is in the bank. So I feel good about that. I'm wondering about these stimulus checks. We have gotten a lot of questions about these checks and people wondering how they might impact their tax returns. What have you got for us on that?
Well, the good thing is they will not negatively impact their tax return. If we have people who see a tax professional, one of the questions that as a tax professional we ask is, did you get the stimulus and how much did you get? Now, some people think that means, oh, you're going to add it to my tax return. The reason for it is that the stimulus is really a recovery credit. It's called the recovery rebate credit on the 2020 return. If someone did not get the advance equal to what they would have gotten based on the numbers for 2020, they have an opportunity to get that additional payment, or for some people, a payment on by filing their 2020 tax return.
Okay, so it's not really much to worry about. But what if they didn't receive a stimulus check? Should you do?
If they did not receive a stimulus check, you can go to the IRS website, and there is a way to look through the website. It asks you for Social Security number, birth date, your address, and zip code, and it will tell you when the first stimulus payment was made. It won't tell you how much, but it'll tell you when it was made and how, whether it was a check or a deposit. And the second stimulus check, it will tell you the same information for that. We have found that sometimes when looking at that, it'll say for the second check, the $600 check, not enough information. That's kind of a hard thing to say because it doesn't tell you whether they didn't send the check or whether the check's not been cashed or what the deal is. So what we're suggesting is if you didn't get the $600 check and you go on and look and it doesn't say it was mailed to you or it was sent to you or deposited, then you should file on the 2020 tax return, the recovery rebate credit, and collect and show that extra $600 as due to you through your tax return.
Gotcha. Charitable contributions are also different. Maybe talk about those changes.
Sure. Because when the CARES Act was passed last March of 2020, there was a provision in the CARES Act to help out charities because charities have certainly taken a hit with the COVID reaction as well as anything else. And so what the bill did was to allow people who would not otherwise be able to benefit tax-wise from charitable deductions because they didn't itemize, they would allow those people who do claim the standard deduction to claim an extra $300 deduction for gifts up to $300 that were made to charities. And the gifts had to be made with money rather than goods. So your goodwill and outreach and St. Vincent's contributions do not count toward that. It is actual cash money, whether it's cash or check, that money. And also it cannot be money put into the donor-advised funds. So it's just your normal cash. And up to $300 can be used directly on the tax return without need to itemize. So that's something that people should be aware of. Just a caution that IRS, in the second stimulus bill that was passed, or the budget bill that was passed at the end of the year, they expanded that credit for 2021 to $600 on a married joint return. But on the same bill, they added a penalty so that if anyone is caught taking the deduction without the proper backup for it, there is a special penalty for that. So, you know, this is not the go-ahead to say, oh, yeah, $300, I must have given that. You better have the backup for it. That it's a nice gift, tax return-wise, but not without consequences if you're just writing a number in there.
Yeah, so it just all goes to making sure you keep track and a record of those payments in some fashion, for sure.
Yes, yes.
Well, every phone line is full, so let's go to the phones and talk to Kay first in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Kay.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, sadly, my mom passed away September 5th, and I'm the executor, and I'm just trying to understand how this, for the 2020 taxes, how it's all going to work. Like, I know I've already got her information. I've already filed an estate, got a state tax ID, but I don't know, how do I split it between the estate, her death, or can I put everything on her tax return for 2020? I'm so confused.
It's an excellent question, Kay, and one that a lot of people have to face somewhere in their lifetime. So here's the deal as far as mom's 1040 return. Mom's income on her 1040 return goes from January 1 of 2020 up through 9/5 of 2020. So everything that she has received at that point in time belongs on that 1040 return. The 1041 return, the estate tax return that you got the ID number for, and it is a form 1041 estate income tax. That form contains any income received by the estate from the day after your mother died until the end of the year. And estates can actually be fiscal year returns. So it technically could go from 9/6 to 8/31 of 2021. But it contains any income that the estate assets might produce during that period of time. Does that help?
It absolutely does. Now, she had a trust, so she didn't have to go through probate or anything. Everything transferred to me, so I took possession of that. If I took possession of that in that time, does that become my burden then, or how does that work?
Okay. If your mother had a trust, and it would be the term we normally use for the trust, not knowing anything different with it, if it was a living trust that only went into effect at the time she died, it would be the same type of thing. Any income, all of the assets that she had labeled for the trust that were trust assets after she died would go into this trust. And any income that those assets generated during that time period would be trust income. If you distributed all of those assets to yourself, then the income, and depending on how quickly you did that, the income then would flow to you and may not at all have any income at the trust level. So that all depends on how quickly those things happened.
Ah, there we go. Kay, thank you so much for calling. It's good information for a lot of people, I'm pretty sure. Thank you. Heidi in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Heidi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You there?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. My husband started taking collecting Social Security last year. He also does some part-time jobs occasionally, only a few thousand dollars a year. I'm wondering if he needs to report that on a regular basis, or can he just report that on his federal return? And I thought I had read that I do have to report it because it could affect his monthly stipend.
Okay. You have several issues going on here. First of all, is your husband retired because he's reached retirement age, or is his retirement due to a disability?
It is a disability, but he does not collect disability. So.
Okay. So did he retire on normal Social Security because he's age 62, 65, 66, you know, whatever his age is? Or is it a disability type of Social Security?
No, it is not disability.
Okay. Then depending on his age, his income that he can earn might be for tax purposes or for Social Security benefit purposes. It depends on what that age is. If he is what we call full retirement age, which used to be 65, now it is anywhere between 66 and 67, depending on what your age is at that point or when you were born. If it is prior to full retirement age for that person, then the earnings that you have are at a certain level before they, if you earn under that particular level, then you may have to give back Social Security benefits based on the excess over that dollar amount. That idea has nothing to do with income tax. That's strictly a Social Security benefit issue. The other half of it is that all of your income is subject to income tax reporting unless there's something special with it. So Social Security is a factor in income tax reporting as well as the income from jobs. Now, when you say jobs, I'm assuming that he's receiving a W-2 for those jobs and not self-employed. Is that correct?
No, he is not receiving a W-2.
So he is self-employed?
Correct.
If he is self-employed, then the self-employment income is collected generally on a Schedule C unless it's farming income, but it's collected on a Schedule C. And the income against the expenses is a taxable event, and it is subject to Social Security just like the FICA and Medicare tax, but the self-employed side of that, it is subject to that as well, even though he's receiving Social Security benefits. And the same income level applies to self-employment income as it does to earned income if you are below full retirement age. So you may be receiving Social Security benefits and paying Social Security tax on the same return.
Hmm.
Did I just further confuse you?
A little. He is 62. He'll be 63 in April.
Okay, so then he is governed by the maximum earning tests in terms of giving back Social Security benefits if he makes too much money. And for 2020, that maximum earnings is $18,240. So for him, that would be the net number on the bottom of the Schedule C. If that is that together with any W-2s he might have. If you are over that amount, then you may lose some of the Social Security benefits. But again, the loss of those benefits has nothing to do with the taxation that shows up on the tax return.
Got it. Heidi, I hope you have that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your taxes today on the Ideas Network with Mary Mellum, tax professional of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her back. And lots of callers online. Let's take another call. Ann in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I'm in the age bracket where the standard deduction of $14,050 is in excess of what I could deduct if I were to itemize. And last December, I wondered if I should hold off on paying my property tax for 2020 until January, when it was actually finally due, in the interest of perhaps preserving a double deduction on property tax in some future year. And I was advised not to do such a thing because even though I wasn't eligible to itemize, I would be hurting myself as far as the Wisconsin return is concerned. So I wondered what your views on that were. And I also wanted to ask you, please, what is the fair range for professional tax preparation cost in Wisconsin, understanding that it varies, but just for a non-itemized 1040 and a standard tax return in Wisconsin and a Wisconsin return? Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tackle the first part of that, and then we'll come to the other question that you ask. First of all, the standard deduction, it has been a trick. I know trick sounds a bad word, but a tax-saving technique to compile, to save up all your itemized deductions into 1 year so that you can get over the standard deduction and itemize 1 year and use the standard. And it's been a good technique over the years. However, when the 2017 Tax Act passed that doubled the standard deduction, basically, that technique wasn't as useful. It also, at that time, put a cap on property on taxes, income tax, property tax, personal property tax, at $10,000. So people who itemized in the past with taxes, doubling up on property taxes, kind of lost the advantage of doing that in some cases. So we don't see that doubling up of itemized deductions in 1 year like we used to. Now, even though that did happen in the past, Wisconsin kind of worked against it because the Wisconsin property tax credit, the rent credit, the property tax credit, is capped at $300. And it takes about $2,500 to get to that $300. That means if your property taxes are over $2,500 roughly, you're only going to get $300. So if you paid $6,000 of property taxes in 1 year and no property taxes in the other year, you're going to get a $300 credit 1 year, and you lose any of that potential $300 in the second year. So when you are trying to double up on itemized deductions, you have to look at it both ways to see how much you gained versus how much you lost. So it's a scary thing. When people do benefit from doubling up on itemized deductions, what I usually try to tell them is pay some part of your property taxes in the first year. Hopefully your doubling up on itemized deductions is in some other place, like paying an extra mortgage payment, like 13 payments in 1 year, and doubling up on your charity, or maybe maximizing medical payments in that year. But put a little bit of property tax into the non-itemizing year to preserve some of the Wisconsin benefit. So I hope that helps out a little bit. It takes a little bit of looking to figure that one out.
What about the rates? Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The other half of your question is a tough one to answer, because there are no standards for fees. As an enrolled agent, which I am, the Circular 230, which we're governed under, says that an enrolled agent cannot charge an unconscionable fee. Now, that's a tough definition, and it has no dollars with it. The only thing that I can suggest to you, if you want to know fees, is that you can ask a company that you're going to. And the one of the things that is tradition is that the more education a tax professional has, the more you can expect to pay for it. And for lack of a better term, the more letters behind your name generally means that the fees will be commensurative with those initials. So if you go to someone who is not an enrolled agent, is not a CPA, is not an attorney, their fees may be lower. But you have to weigh the value of what you're getting. And again, keep in mind that there are designations. An enrolled agent is someone who has strictly dedicated their practice to taxation. And there is a three-part exam that an enrolled agent must pass to be recognized before the IRS as an enrolled agent, and there are CEs, continuing education credits, that must be taken every year to maintain that. A CPA is also a designation, but a CPA does not guarantee that they're tax experts. CPAs are experts in the accounting field. Some choose to focus on taxation. Some choose not to focus on taxation. So when you are looking at that, you need to ask the question, what's your area of expertise? And then attorneys also. We know that there are all kinds of attorneys. There are some attorneys that focus on tax. They're tax attorneys. But a criminal attorney probably wouldn't be the best place to go get your tax return done. All that I can say is you are free to ask. The only warning I give you is that if you are calling a tax professional at this time of the year to ask how much they charge, you are probably not going to get a very nice answer, because most of them are busy doing tax returns and don't want to give you an idea. The best time to look at the fee structure would be prior to tax season, maybe in the fall of the year. Look ahead, ask for rates, ask about appointments and things like that. I think you'll get your best advice or best learning if you work that way.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Thank you very much, Ann, for that question. I'm sure it's a question a lot of people had. Damien in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Damien.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, I have a student debt less than $10,000. I know there's legislation coming up, supposedly, of student debt forgivability. that's a word. But so should I hold off on filing my taxes if that goes through? Obviously, that's going to affect my taxes, because that's the only thing I have that's financially holding me back that would affect me with my taxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question.
Damien.
Number one, I like to tell people that the bills in Congress are bills. That doesn't mean that it's going to be passed. As a tax professional, I pray that the bill that is being passed has nothing to do with the tax returns that we are filing. Therefore, I would not want to hold up a tax return. If student debt is forgiven, first of all, debt forgiveness is taxable. In and of itself, if your debt is forgiven, there is a chance of, in the general laws of income tax, debt forgiveness is taxable. Now, there are a variety, there are about five different circumstances under which debt cancellation is not taxable. When they pass, or if they pass this bill, and it is a big if they pass the bill regarding the forgiveness of student tax debt, they may say it's non-taxable. They have done that with principal residence debt when it's forgiven. They have done that with farm debt, with insolvency, certain types of real estate, and just lately with the PPP loans that businesses are getting. But if they do not include it, in the year in which it's forgiven, it could be taxable income. The only impact that student debt right now has on your tax return, the 2020, is that if you have paid interest on the student debt, there is a chance that that interest is a deduction. And based on what I know from the CARES Act or from the budget bill, I'm not sure which one it was, but the student debt was put on kind of hold, and if it is the government type of student debt, I believe interest may not be accruing on it right now. And if that's the case, you may not have the student loan interest that you would have had in another year. But I have no reason to think that you should hold up a tax return because you think that maybe the student debt is going to be forgiven. I don't see that as anything on the tax return.
All right. There you go, Damien. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Gail emailed to ask this situation. Divorced couple recently has equally shared custody of three independent children. The divorce agreement dictates that each parent claims one of them as dependents each year, and that the third dependent alternates between parents every other year. Can both parents claim head of household each year? And if so, what requirements do they have to meet? Are there special things they should document to do this? Also, do they both need to submit form 8332 yearly to release their claim to the alternating dependent?
That's a mouthful of a question. And let's see if we can kind of break this down. In a divorce situation, the dependency exemption for the children, this is tax law, not civil law under the divorce decree. Under tax law, dependency, the qualifying child, which is generally a child, under the age of 19, there are provisions for a child older than that, but I'll get to that. But if the child is under age 19, they can be a qualifying child. And to be a qualifying child, you must reside with the parent more than half the year. And another one of the stipulations is the child cannot provide more than half of their own support. For a qualifying child, it doesn't say anything about anybody else's support other than the child providing their own. Now, it is the half the year that is a big issue when there is joint custody, because joint custody says we have equal custody, which in a normal year, that's half of 365 days. And we don't cut a day in half, so that generally means that one parent has more days than the other. That's where all of the mess gets. From an IRS standpoint, it is where that child resides for more than half the year, that parent has the legal right to claim that child. If the right to claim the child is given up by that physically custodial parent, then that parent has to file the Form 8332 that you mentioned that basically says, I have the right to claim this child, but I waive the right to claim that child to the other party. Head of household comes into play there because head of household is a status that gives tax benefits. And head of household says that I provide more than half the cost of maintaining the home, which is the home of myself and a qualifying child. And so a parent has to have a qualifying child with them in order to have head of household status. The divorce decrees kind of get in the middle of that, and they want to say, okay, let's play nice. Both of you can be head of household because each of you get a child. That can be the case as long as technically that child lives at that household more than half the days of the year. The other child, going back and forth, technically where that child belongs, head of household-wise, is where the child lives for more than half the year. And the idea is that some of the credits will give you more credits based on more children. Hmm. So IRS doesn't really get involved as long as parents play nice. They have a whole set of rules that if parents don't play nice and one says, it's mine, and the other says, no, it's not, they have what they call tiebreaker rules that go down to look at if they're equally days, then we look at who makes more money, and it goes to the parent with the higher AGI levels. So I guess the biggest thing that I could say is keep a log of how long that child physically lives with you. That's what will help with the head of household status. Make sure that you, as the parent that is providing the household where a child lives, has records to prove that you have paid more than half the cost of maintaining that home. If you're there with the child, it's a no-brainer. It's when you are living with someone else that you're not married to that that head of household issue comes into play. So it is a complicated issue, and it can be a big mess. Now, on top of that, the IRS also has a Form 8867 that, as tax professionals, we're required to fill out that form to say that we have informed our clients and ask the right questions about the child and about the living arrangements and the credits and things, because there is a fine for us as professionals if we just blanketly hand out things.
Okay. There you go. Thank you.
A real interesting things today.
Yeah, we are indeed. Thank you, Gail, for that email. Well, Duane in Wausau, what's on your mind?
Well, hello, Larry and Mary. So I just saw in the news last week that if you had a child in the last year, they should file as soon as possible in case this next stimulus check goes through, then it would be on record that you, you know, have had a second child to get that credit, and it would save you a lot of paperwork later. And didn't know she had, Mary had heard anything about that. My daughter, she filed right away when I told her that. And second question real quick is, if you turn, like if we're born in 1960, I don't know if she knows about Social Security, when can you actually start drawing, like I'll be 62 2022. So when can you start drawing at 62, even though you're born in 60? So those are my questions.
Okay. Let's take the first one about the stimulus and the child in 2020. First of all, as I mentioned before, the stimulus, even though you got it before, and there's a little confusion about the fact that you got some in 2021, the stimulus is a credit on the 2020 return. And as such, the credit is given based on the numbers, the income level, and the number of people on the 2020 return. So if your daughter had a child in 2020, any stimulus that she may have gotten already had nothing to do with that child. Therefore, by filing her 2020 return, she will calculate the stimulus credit, and it will say that you didn't get the stimulus for the child for either the first check or the second check, and if her income is below the proper level, that could mean an extra $1,100 on her 2020 return. Now, that takes care of the last two stimuluses. If we have a third stimulus, I pray that it will have nothing to do with the filing of your 2020 return because it is happening in 2021. And so if it is like the other stimulus, it would be a recovery credit on the 2021 return. But how does the IRS get that money out? And so the IRS, if they follow the same pattern that they did with the 2020 stimulus, they will look back at your most recent return. Again, depending how soon it is, if the stimulus goes out a little bit further, they may have the data from the 2020 returns to base it on. If not, they'll look back at the 19 return like they did for the last one, where if you hadn't filed the 19 return or it hadn't been processed, they went back to the 18 return. So it doesn't hurt to get it in. Keep in mind that IRS didn't start receiving returns until February 12th, which means they have a lot on their plate. And how quickly they get through those and the stimulus may come along is going to depend on that. So it doesn't hurt to file it as soon as it is, but she certainly will get benefit of the prior stimulus.
There you go. Thank you, Duane, for calling. Appreciate it.
Okay. Let me just get back. He had two questions.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Okay, go ahead.
The second question he had was about drawing Social Security. It is my understanding that they have not changed the beginning date withdrawing Social Security, only the date for the maximum Social Security. And I talked about that being 65, 66, and some factor of 66 and 2 months for full retirement age. So if you want to retire at 62, it is my understanding that you can. But knowing that that takes away, you will only get a portion, and I don't know what that percentage of your benefits, your full benefits would be if you take it at age 62. But people do retire at age 62. Just have that idea in mind. So that takes care of those two questions.
All right. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals from Green Bay. It's great to have her with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, tax professional with Ash Schwabenen Tax Professionals of Green Bay. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. We'll jump right back to the phones. Lots of callers online. Steve in Wausau, it's your turn. What's on your mind?
Just wanted to check on something. Would it be enough accuracy looking through my past taxes? And I usually got a Social Security benefit statement telling me how much I got in total benefit. And I don't know if it went out with the trash, but I never got anything this year that I know of. But could I go back and use that your new benefits that they sent me in November of 2019 and just take that figure, those figures on there for Medicare and for the actual Social Security I received and just multiply those by 12 and use those numbers? Would that be close enough?
If I understand your question, what you're trying to do is fill in your Social Security received on your tax return, and you didn't get the 1099 SA for 2020. Is that what you're asking?
That's the question, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, the 1099 SA is the best thing, and first thing I probably would do is call the IRS and ask them, or call the Social Security office and ask them to send me a new copy. If you have withholding, you would on your Social Security, you would definitely want that. If you don't have social withholding on Social Security, you can calculate how much you have and put it in. And if you remember, the Social Security sends out a statement at the beginning of the year. Actually, it comes out like in the end of 2020. That will tell you what your Social Security that you're supposed to receive in the future year, and that certainly would tell you. You know, knowing what your regular benefits, what you get in your check is deceiving because you might have Medicare, you might have the Medicare B, you might have the D, you might have the C, and so you can't use the net check that you get. But if you know what the gross is and you don't have any withholding, you should be able to use that number.
There you go. Thank you, Steve, for calling. Well, Mike in Baraboo, what's on your mind?
Yes, hello, Mary and Larry. I'm self-employed and have an employee. I'm on Medicare, my wife and I, but I'd like to get health insurance for my employee, and I don't know if he's even eligible for health exchange. But my question is how can I compensate him for premiums that he would need to pay and have it be a tax business deduction for me?
Okay. That's, again, another good question today. Back in 2010, when we had the Affordable Care Act, it did a number on health insurance for employers. Prior to that, you could provide health benefits, pay for those health benefits, and kind of pick and choose who you were going to do it for. When the Affordable Care Act came out, they applied discrimination rules to health benefits, and it said, if you provide health benefits for any employee, you have to provide it for everybody. And when I'm saying health benefits, prior to that, if I provided health benefits to someone, it wasn't a taxable benefit to them. So this discrimination rule gets messy in here. So there's a couple of ways that you can do it. You can give your employee more money, increase their wages. Wages are a deductible benefit to you. And give the employee more wages so that the employee can go out and buy his own health insurance. Then the employee would be responsible to take that money and could go to the Affordable Care or go to the health care exchange or to any other person that sells health insurance. The downside to that, of course, is the employee pays taxes on it and you pay payroll taxes on it. There is also another way that you can set up. It is a certain flex spending account. And with that flex spending account, you can provide a maximum. There's benefits with it that are a maximum amount of benefits that you could provide tax-free to the employee so that the employee can go out and get his own health insurance. So you kind of have to look at it both ways. In your situation, you would be hard-pressed to get a group policy because you don't have enough to be a group. So I would say either taxable compensation or you need to look for the special flex spending arrangement that allows you to pay health insurance through that.
All right, there you go. And where would you look for that flex spending?
I would go to the IRS website, and off the top of my head, there is a term for it. I would Google or go to the IRS website and put in employer-provided health insurance or small employer-provided health insurance.
And there we go.
It seems like the number that I remember is somewhere around $10,000 that you could set aside to pay without having it to be taxable compensation.
Okay.
But again, it's a special program you'd have to set up that way.
Yeah. Mike, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Kathy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question regarding donations. I gave to a food pantry in 2020 about 9 months. Every month I gave them a check. I just found out, however, that they're not registered with the government, and I'm wondering, is that going to be a legitimate donation, or does that just cancel itself out?
Okay.
For my taxes? That's, yeah.
Again, a very good question. To be a charitable deduction, the organization that you give to must be a 501c3 organization. And if the food pantry is just a group of people getting together, collecting food and dispersing the food, and they have not become a 501c3 organization, there is no charitable deduction. If you have talked to the food pantry and asked them, and they've told you, no, we're not a 501c3, the answer is that you were a very nice person, but it's not going to translate anything to your tax return. But again, some of the food pantries are linked to churches or schools or things like that, and if they are a part of those organizations, they might have the nonprofit status as a part of that.
Oh.
So, there are churches. I know in Green Bay, De Pere area, there are churches that sponsor the food pantry, and giving it to that food pantry is an extension of giving it to the church or the organization that is a nonprofit that sponsors it. So, you know, if they legitimately say, we're not a 501c3 organization, and they are not partnering with a 501c3 organization, you have no deduction.
All right. So you need to do a little further checking, I think, on that, Kathy, before you fill your taxes out and find out more from the organization. Jeff in Superior called to ask how to file an amended tax return. Is there a form? This is for state and for federal.
Again, good questions today.
Yeah.
For the amended return for the federal is called a 1040X. The amended return for Wisconsin is called a Form 1. Now, I say that in jest. or I mean, I say that because the amended return for Wisconsin looks just like the one that the original return that you filed, except there is a small box on the face of the Wisconsin return that says, check this box if it's an amended return. The 1040X for federal says, column one, what were your old numbers on your return? Column two, what were the changes? Column three, what's the new numbers? The form one for Wisconsin just says, redo it with the new numbers and tell us that this is not the same old return.
Okay. Mary Mellum, our guest today, doesn't she do a fantastic job of tax professional with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals out of Green Bay? She'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks again for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about filing your income taxes on the show today. Mary Mellum back with us to talk about filing your 2020 tax returns. Her business is Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals. They consult with other tax professionals, give them advice as well. And they teach tax seminars around the country. So what questions do you have about filing your taxes? Join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mary, we have callers on the line, so let's go to the phones here. Kathy and Oshkosh, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much for this program. Am I correct in hearing that if you give $300 or more to a single charity in a year, you have to send in documentation? And then I have another question.
Okay, let's take the first answer. I mean, the first question is, the answer is no. But let me tell you what it really means. The $300 to one organization says that if you give more than $250 to any charity, and I would do it at the $250 because when I say more than, the laws sometimes are written $250 or more than $250. And so for lack of having to remember that, I just say if you give $250 or more to any one organization in a year, you must have, I call it a thank you letter, an acknowledgement from that organization that they received the money and that they provide, you were provided with no gifts and services as a result of that. Or if, like in public television as an example, when you donate to public television and they offer you videos or things, they will send you a letter that says, you gave us $300. The value of the video was $20. Your net contribution is $280. And that's what you have to have. You do not have to send that in with your tax return. But should the IRS decide to ask you about it, you must be able to produce a return, a statement like that dated no later than the day you file your tax return. So you can't go back 2 years later and ask for it because it's too late. So it has to be timely acknowledgement of that gift, but not to be submitted with the tax return unless you're under audit.
All right. There you go, Kathy. Thank you. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. So this has been life-changing for me. I am a live-in caregiver. I live in a private home with three women with disabilities, and I've done this for 9 years. And I just found out last year that because my address is exactly the same as theirs, and They are funded. My clients are funded with a community-based waiver. I am not required to pay state or federal taxes. And, you know, even so I found this out by accident from somebody that works at a different agency doing the same thing that I do. And I went to H&R Block, and they had not heard of it, but with some research, they found it. And so as a result, I got back 100% of my taxes last year, plus they went back 3 years. And so I ended up getting back almost $30,000, just like that, just because I found out about this rule that I had never heard of before. And I don't know if your guest has heard of it, and I've been looking through my emails and have not found the one I'm looking for that would give you the name of the tax law. But as soon as I find it, I certainly will send it to you.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it.
Now, well, go ahead,
and
Mary.
Do you live? I mean, do you own the home?
No.
Okay. So you live in the home and provide care for them in their home, and
yeah,
they pay you for that.
I work for an agency that staffs this home for these clients, and so, yeah, they are charged a fee by that agency, and the agency pays me. I am an employee of an agency.
Okay. I have to plead ignorance because based on the circumstances you're describing, I have not heard of that either. The reason I was asking you about whether you own the home is because there is a code section that allows, it's called foster care payments, and it says if you provide services in your own home for people who are placed by an agency, that income is not taxable. But I have never heard of you being able to live in a home, provide services, and not pay taxes on that. So I would be thrilled to know the site for that.
Also, thank you. There's a very comprehensive list of frequently asked questions put out by the IRS talking specifically about this subject.
Very interesting. I'd love to know what it is, because the foster care payment is certainly one that is non-taxable and has been discussions because it allows parents who receive foster care payments not to pay taxes on those. And that has been a discussion and has allowed some IRA benefits and stuff in situations like that. But I would love to see the site that allows you as non-homeowner to have free income for that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Ann, I hope you can find that and email that to information, if you don't find it before the end of the show, email that information to Mary. I guess if you went online to Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals Green Bay, that would come up, Mary?
Yes. And
all right,
please just reference the Larry Mueller Show, and then we'll know where it comes from.
All right. Ann, thank you so much. Interesting news. Jim in Greendale, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
I had a question. I'm on Medicare. I happen to retire from a company that subsidizes us in our HSA or HRA. I'm not sure which one. And do I have to put that as a income? Because they annually put money into that fund. Is that considered income?
Okay, let me ask again. You are retired from this company?
Yes.
Okay, and as a retirement benefit, they provide this for you?
Yes, annually.
Okay. As a retirement benefit, I do not believe you have to include anything if it falls under those particular programs, because many times retirement contracts in the past have provided health insurance to retirees as a part of their retirement package, and it has been a tax-free benefit.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
If it were a taxable benefit based on how it's set up with this company, you should receive either a W-2 from them or a 1099-R. Sometimes we'll see that with people whose companies provide life insurance, and the life insurance may not be a tax-free benefit, and they get either the 1099-R or the W-2 with just that benefit listed on it. So if it's,
correct.
If you aren't receiving that, chances are they've done everything they can do to provide a tax-free benefit.
Okay, because they do give us a small life insurance also, but I do get that statement, but I did not get any type of a W-2 or 1099 for the HSA.
I suspect it's not an HSA, only because people who are on Medicare generally are not eligible for HSA contributions.
Probably something else.
It could be the HRA, but I'm suspecting it's some kind of a health benefit that is provided to you as a retiree.
Yeah, and if it was going to be taxed, if it had tax implications, you're getting a statement from them on the insurance, but not on the other. My guess is that it's not a tax event then, right, Mary?
That's what I would say, that they've done everything right on their side to provide a tax-free benefit in retirement.
There you go, Jim. Some more good news for you. Thank you for calling. Rod in Madison, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I had a strange situation come up this year for tax purposes. My wife and I just started going through our taxes and pulling things together. We file our own. I have never been in a 401k. I do not like dealing with banks. And on my W-2 form, I retired from this company 7.5 years ago full-time, and then I worked a limited basis for the last 7 years, and I've finally given it up. I'm just an on-call emergency fill-in for the company. And on my W-2 statement, it showed that I had a contribution to a 401k. And I went, where did this come from? Well, apparently the company, the first of last year, started a 401k program for all of their employees. And normally I would think you'd have to sign up for it. Well, this was one that they put everybody into and you had to sign out of it. And since I don't deal with banks, I didn't look at the paperwork that close and I just tossed it. Now I found out I have $158 in a 401k. I do my own retirement through an investment company, and I do the maximum contribution every year to my IRA that I have. It is not a Roth. Now I'm wondering, do I have a problem for filing my taxes for the last year because I was in a 401k that I said I wasn't involved with, and is that going to be an issue for $158?
Good question, Rod. It depends partly on how rich you are. If you are a person who is in a 401k, I'm assuming if you are making an IRA contribution, I'm assuming that you have earned income large enough to be at least equal to the IRA contribution that you're making. Is that true?
Yes, I give the max each year. The maximum is $7,000.
Okay. So the only impact of having a 401k is that if you're covered under a qualified pension plan and your income is too high, your IRA contribution may be limited. If you had earned income and were not covered under an IRA were under a qualified pension plan, it wouldn't matter what your income is. But here's the income level, and I'm assuming you're married filing a joint return. And does your wife, is your wife covered under a qualified plan?
Myself, and yes, she is covered under plan, but we do reference to the fact that she is and I am not.
Okay. If one spouse is non-covered, then your income level, let's see, you said she is not and you are, or she is and you weren't up to this time.
And on an annual basis, I have maybe only earned $8,000 to $9,000 a year in filling in at what I do for the company.
Okay. So I'm not sure if I understood what you asked, but let me assume this. If you are both covered now as under qualified retirement plans, the maximum that you can make and still deduct an IRA is $103,000.
If
you are over $103,000 collectively, modified AGI, then it may be phased down, and at $123,000 or more, it is phased out. That is the implication of being covered under a qualified plan. And in defense of the employer is required, when they set up plans, not to discriminate, and there are some kinds of plans that the employer can set up where they just enroll you because of discrimination rules. They set the plan up and everybody's covered.
Oh.
So I think you need to check with your employer if, you know, I don't know that you can undo anything for now, and if you're retired, obviously it isn't an issue for the year. But if you have high enough income, it could impact your contribution for this year. You are correct.
All right. There you go, Rod. Thank you. Andy in Cudahy, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. This is back to the old federal stimulus $1,200 check. We know on the federal it's really not going to hurt us. But what is the state doing with that money? Are we required to list that as part of our gross income?
The answer is no. The state of Wisconsin has gone along with the IRS as far as the stimulus payments being non-taxable.
Okay, there you go. Quick answer there. Tony and Stevens Point, hi.
Hi. So my question is regarding the federal solar tax credit. I filed jointly with my wife, and usually we don't have a tax liability at the end of the year. So my question is kind of twofold. Can that tax credit be applied for a rebate, or if it cannot, can I increase my federal tax liability by having my employer take out less taxes out of my paycheck?
Okay. What credit are you referring to? You said forward tax credit?
Solar, I think.
Oh.
Solar tax credit.
The solar tax credit. I see. The solar tax credit, I believe that one is carries forward. Let me just take a look and see if I can believe it, because I can check to see. I believe that there is a carry-forward feature on the solar tax credit because it is a large tax credit that you can have. Let me see if I can
find it.
And let me see if I can find out if there is a carry forward on it. Let's see. Solar credit.
Mary Mellum, our guest, searching for a solar tax credit here on the Ideas Network. Oh, man.
Let's see. Carry forward. Let's see. It is not a refundable credit. However, it can be carried back 1 year and forward 20. That's what I'm seeing just in quickly looking at it. Code section 48 is the code section at the IRS that it comes under.
And there you go.
Let's see. Ah, actually, different space. I think that may be the business side of it. The credit exceeds your liability. You can carry forward for 5 years.
Okay. There you go, Tony. Jan, have you got a quick question?
Oh, yes, I do. I am pulling over off the highway right now. My question is, I work search and rescue canines, have for over 22 years. I have been in the past been able to deduct the expenses of those canines, their food, their vet bills, et cetera. I work with a nonprofit search and rescue group out of Wisconsin. Last 4 years, I have been told that I cannot deduct anything for those canines. Has anything changed where I could?
Okay, first of all, are you an employee of the search and rescue organization?
Complete volunteer. We do not charge for our services.
Okay. As if you were, if you were not to feed these animals, who would feed them?
Nobody.
Okay. The only, what I would say is that if you are feeding them in lieu of the search and rescue organization that is a nonprofit, it is possible that your donation of the food is as if it were a donation to the nonprofit. But that would be the only area. Right. I mean, that would be the way that it would be a charitable contribution. If you are a volunteer, that's if you are a volunteer and incur expenses, I should say, if you're a volunteer for a 501c3 charity and you incur expenses in your capacity as a volunteer, then they could be charitable contributions. I'm not
sure
how they've done before for you.
There you go. Thank you so much. And Mary, thank you so much. I'm so glad to see you're coming back March 16th. Thank you again for being with us today.
You are very welcome.
Mary Mellum, tax professional of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. She does an outstanding job. It's great to have her with us. She'll be back on March 16th. Tomorrow, Susan Carpenter will be with us on Garden Talk to talk about native plants. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.